zoom, 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 zoom. Back in history, before time began, all the real cool cats had a solid plan. When they dug a nervous chick, they all to a man went. Ape call, dooliaba, ape call, dooliaba, ape call, dooliaba. You wanna be cool, man? Go ape. Young Mighty Joe swinging through the trees was the king of everything that roosted in the leaves. But when he saw a girl ape hanging in the breeze, he went. Ape call, dooliaba, ape call, dooliaba, ape call, dooliaba. You like to be hip, boy? Go ape. Big dinosaur was a long, tall lizard. He drift through the jungle like a slow blizzard. But when he got a double take at lady lizard, right, he did.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics, issue 186, encroaching, creeping ever closer to the 200 mark. I am your host, creeping. Andrew Farm. Creeping. With me, as always, is my my life mate, my rock, my island. Yeah. The Jedi, Cole Houston.
You did all Simony on me.
I did. We still have the debate as to who's the Garfunkel and who's the Simon. I think it fluctuates.
Exactly.
And we have a special treat for you. Guest prior to this, but anytime we can finagle the guest we have tonight onto the show, we are always happy to do so. Michael Price joins us once again to discuss tonight's topic, which I think we gave a name to very, very shortly before the show started. Cole, why don't you describe what's happening tonight?
Well, we're going to talk about a mess of Tarzan comics, as coined by Michael himself. Welcome to the show, Michael, by the way.
Yes. My pleasure. Thank you so much.
We, as I explained to Mike before the show, Andy, I thought if there was any one guest I could find who might be able to espouse a love and knowledge of Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan, other than myself, which, you know, I could just sort of inflect two different voices and we could have just faked it. But Michael, I thought, would be ideal because your long history with comics.
Yeah.
That seems to rack up pretty substantially after a while. It never was the intention. It was like a diversion from the newspaper career, but one thing leads to another, and the next thing you know, you're neck deep in the racket.
Everything's a racket tonight.
That's
too,
right.
Guys. Just so you know.
And this Angelo might show up, you know.
He very well might. He's
known for his rackets.
He's known in the Burroughs as Edgar Brown Rice Burroughs. So tonight's going to be interesting for me because I really don't have any. I was like when we were discussing who was going to be on the show and Cole was like, I would really like to have Michael on the show. I was like, please, for the love of God, have him on the show because I don't have a compass for this issue of I like Tarzan, I like Edgar Rice Burroughs, but as far as the comics, some of the maybe was he ever did they ever do Classics Illustrated of Tarzan?
Not to my knowledge. I think that was all tied up with the Burroughs estate and they did their licensing with newspaper syndicates, and of course, comic books, not Classics Illustrated. I'd have to go back through the greater sweep of Classics Illustrated. I'm sure they did a Jungle Book, a Kipling's, things like that. But
yeah. Kipling didn't have an estate running roughshod over his work, so.
Right. It's like, no, that's just the nature of the business. Once you lapse into the public domain, as Burroughs did not for many, many years, it's like, yeah, I'll renew his option. Just rip that one off out of the library.
That's right. We could do Tarzan or, hey, Kipling's free.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We could do Ricky,
yeah, there
and Tommy.
Was,
we could do whatever we want, you know?
There was a chronic joke going around Universal Pictures in the 30s. When their adaptation of Dickens' Mystery of Edwin Drood tanked at the box office, and they went and turned right around and said, "Oh, we're going to do Great Expectations," and one of the trade papers joked that Studio Chief Carl Lindley has decided not to pick up Mr. Dickens' option. And Burroughs, no problem with that. Burroughs himself took a hand in his own adaptations at one point when in the 30s, when he was really not that pleased with Johnny Weissmuller's portrayal. And so he had some adventures in making his own Tarzan movie for a while there. Tarzan the Fearless, and it didn't turn out that well, but Burroughs, by golly, that's like Stephen King has to do a remake of The Shining because he didn't like the Kubrick version, and of course his King's version turns out ghastly.
With all deference to Steven Weber, who I really hope is a fan of this show, Wings for Life. It was not great. It was not great. And it's interesting that you would bring up immediately. We start talking about the film adaptations because one of the reasons that it became important to do this when we were doing it is that the latest film adaptation just was released.
Yes, indeed, The Legend of Tarzan, which I highly recommend.
Timing is quite nice. Yes, timing is quite pleasing, and quite an amazing coincidence that you had this scheduled already before we had a release date on the movie, I think.
4 years ago, yeah. Michael. Four.
Okay.
I've been begging for this one for years.
Synchronicity kicks in, you know. Right.
On the off chance I would happen to cross paths with someone who would make it even more interesting.
But pride of authorship, pride of authorship is very important when you're talking about adapting a famous property like Tarzan. And Edgar Rice Burroughs really did take his craft seriously. He began writing as a career and not a sideline upon finding himself disgusted with an issue of the Argosy All Story Weekly magazine. And threw it down and says, well, if I couldn't write a better story than that, I'd quit. So his wife says, well, why don't you?
It's almost like Newman's Own, you know? It's like he didn't like Caesar salad. He's like, I got all my own dressing.
See, and there are cultural parallels all through this. Well, of course, he concocted John Carter,
yes,
A Princess of Mars, and everything fell into place from there. And what a prolific cat. I mean, he actually left unfinished work upon his death, one of which stories was completed in very recent years by my pal Joe Lansdale down in South Texas, Southeast Texas.
That's
so.
Was that the one that was adapted by Dark Horse, or was this another?
That's the Dark Horse project.
Excellent.
Yes,
that was really neat because by that time I had managed to track down the Ballantine editions of all the Tarzan, all 24 of those.
Oh yeah.
Quite a feat, and it was almost like it was easier to find in used bookstores brittle old copies from like 1947 or something than to find the 80s Ballantine editions.
I'm looking right now at my 10-foot shelf of the Ace paperback edition.
Oh, wow.
Beautiful covers, mostly by Roy Crinkle, who was the protege of J. Allen St. John, who was the definitive Tarzan illustrator. And
see, that's why Andy really needed you on the show, because he would have had nothing to fill that space with.
I went and got a glass of wine. I'm sitting in a rollback chair with a glass of wine right now, just listening.
That's the way to do it. Actually, you just sit back and let the beauty of this ridiculous culture just roll over you. I used to, my mentor in the newspaper business, George Turner, used to keep a St. John Tarzan original hanging over his drawing table.
That's amazing.
Having studied under St. John at the Chicago Art Institute of Chicago. And it all clicks together. Everything falls into place. That was about the time George Turner was doing the story called Tarzan and the Crocodile God for one of the Burroughs Estate magazines.
Oh, wow. Yes. And that's another good point, is the Burroughs, the ERBdom and the other, post facto Burroughs storylines.
Mm-hmm.
It just perpetuated this fascinating character that kind of transcends its pulp origins.
Right, exactly. The pulps are a lot more important to what we call literature than a lot of really highfalutin, stuffy, great novels.
I'm still waiting for Tarzan versus Heathcliff, though.
Tarzan of the Moors.
Exactly. I've got many pages of finished and partially finished Tarzan art by George Turner that I'm looking at the possibility of publishing intact. George was some things got abandoned. George had a bad experience with Vern Coryell, the editor of the Burroughs Bulletin. Fellow refused to return his original artwork. This was back in the mid to late 60s, and so he left abandoned a number of pages, but had already gotten some beautiful starts on them. There was a story that George called Tarzan and the Cossacks, which was a takeoff on The Most Dangerous Game.
Oh, neat.
And another story called Tarzan. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and then the other one was called Tarzan and the Perfect Monster, which was inspired by Frankenstein.
Oh, what? Wow. Now that has been something to behold.
Oh, Turner. Well, I've got George's remaining partials from those days, and one of these days they'll probably appear in one of the anthologies.
Well, let me, Michael, who are you? Let me personally encourage you with that project. You have a guaranteed sale of at least one copy right off
two.
Bat.
There, there you go. Well, that's what we do, and that's sometimes I can't believe we get away with doing all this stuff and even building it into careers. Because that's the ideal. That's the ideal of everybody. What do you want to do when you grow up? What are you going to be when you grow up? Well, I want to get away with doing what I like.
Right.
And maybe making a living off of it.
And part of that is why not growing up at all.
Right.
No, important indeed. But the you were asking about the official adaptations. It's not surprising that Gilbertson Publications did not attempt to do Tarzan because, I don't know, maybe there was a bias against pulp literature, and certainly the pulps would not have been considered classics in that day, in the mid-century. Literature is what people happen to be reading. A classic does not necessarily mean a great piece of work. It might mean a piece of work that is definitive of its kind.
And if you look at the body of most of the classics illustrated, they fall into the purview of literature you were compelled to read.
Right. Oh, yeah. Required reading.
But for academia, most of these things would have fallen into obscurity.
Where the red fern grows.
I'm amazed to look back and recall how many junior high school book reports I faked with Classics Illustrated.
Hell yeah. Far
superior to the Tarzan franchise, and it did become a franchise, was confined to the newspaper cartoon syndicate business. And to the, I guess you could say, the major league comic book business. Of course, there were no major league comic book companies in those early years. They were all struggling independents. I suppose Dell would have been the closest.
Yeah, in fact, mentioning Dell, one of the things that fascinated me in looking for, especially for flavor art, some interesting covers from the past, was that Dell, Gold Key, Marvel, DC, and Dark Horse are just the most contemporary of a number of companies, some of which I'm having a hard time determining who the publisher was, that had a hand in bringing Tarzan to comics in black and white or color.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Of course, the early newspaper strip Tarzan was very much a Burroughs favorite artist, Harold Foster, who later wound up doing Prince Valiant.
Oh, wow, yes.
And, of course, Foster, as he would do later with Prince Valiant, did not subscribe to the traditional panel and balloon structure of a comic strip, but rather to an individual drawing with a caption opposed to a word balloon.
He seemed to favor a kind of an illustrated narrative over...
Right, exactly. And so that you can get into endless arguments about, well, how does that be a comic strip if it doesn't have balloons? I'm not going to go there, but because there's already too many people that want to. But the subsequent artists to Foster, just a procession of brilliant artists, most of whom, if not all, were favored by Burroughs himself. He liked to control his character, had more power to him.
Absolutely.
He is known not to have been all that pleased with Harvey Kurtzman and Bill Elder's parody in a magazine called Help. That would have been from the early 60s. But as I've often told many artists who get affronted by parodies of their work, it's like, in order to do a parody or a satire, first you've got to have an affectionate understanding of what you're spoofing.
Absolutely. Right. And what you're spoofing has to be well known enough to be bothered with.
Right, exactly. And of course the general attitude of the indignant creator is I'm making serious art here. It's like, well, all the more reason to spoof it.
<That's right.
laughs> I have Todd Camp and I did a newspaper strip in the early to mid 90s called Moviola, in which we would spoof motion pictures. And one of our strips, I was just doing a new scan on the original artwork the other day, was a Tarzan spoof, imagining a movie, imagining a movie by William Rice Burroughs called Tarzan's Naked Lunch.
Oh, wow.
And I'll have to do something with that one of these days.
I would see that movie.
I think I have. I think I have.
You never know. It's a funny damn thing that so much happens in so short. So much transpires in so short a time that you really don't have time to just soak it all in, and you have to go back and dig to get a fuller appreciation. Of course, while you're going back and digging, something new is happening that you're going to have to go back later and dig for. So it's like living on a cultural treadmill.
That is very well put. And what's fun about this is the more I dug, the more I found just how, you know, it should not be surprising to me that Tarzan has been in the comics pretty much almost the entire history of comics, and seen so many incarnations. And it's very gratifying to me because I, you know, came into Tarzan at a point when somebody was bothering to publish en masse. And that was the aforementioned Ballantine to, you know, take these unabridged versions of each of the books and put them out. And I would go and relentlessly search the B. Dalton and Walden bookstores trying to find, you know, another of the missing copies and try to fill in that blank. And I was inspired to that by my friend David Buns, who's been on the show before, who was encouraging me to read Princess of Mars, to read the John Carter series that
you bet.
I forget who was publishing those simultaneously, a different house.
Those had an extensive run. The Ace editions were generally more consistent, but you had to go to the different series of publishers to get a comprehensive overview, and then you get all those 35-cent and 50-cent paperbacks racked up and ready to go, and it's like, this is so intimidating. but then once you get into it, you realize that Burroughs is an instinctive storyteller, and you don't have to really work to read him.
No, he
does all the work. I mean, his writing is, it's not impeccable, but it is so thoughtfully and carefully put together that it feels easier than it must have been to write.
Oh, I like the way you put that. It was one of the things that fascinated me. One was it's not dwelled upon in Tarzan near as much as in the John Carter books, where Burroughs in John Carter and in, you know, the much maligned Disney adaptation, I really applaud them for building that into the story. is he takes a relationship, a personal relationship, a familial relationship with his title character, in that you know, he is like a cousin or our nephew, rather, or something like that, to John Carter. And so he basically says, you know, all these stories were given to me by this relative about his own adventure. And only at the, in the very first Tarzan novel does Burroughs even hint at the fact that he's basically, what you're reading is him imparting a story that, as he says in the first novel, I had no business telling, as imparted to me by someone who had no business telling me.
Yes, exactly.
And that actually won me a Trivial Pursuit question one time when it was asked who was the first author to incorporate themselves. And the only author I knew who did that was Burroughs. So I went, Rice Burroughs, and it was right. So.
Sure. Well, absolutes are hard to come by, so hold on to that when you might need it later. But I was just mentally inventorying the vast range of artists who have tackled Tarzan in the comics. My personal favorite probably would be a famous cartoonist named Bern Hogarth, and Hogarth would whip me upside the head for calling him a cartoonist. he used to be a regular at the comics conventions. And took himself very seriously. But what a great artist and a master of anatomy. In fact, I learned figure drawing from a series of anatomy textbooks that Hogarth did, and then proceeded to violate every rule because that's what a cartoonist does. But, you know, I mean, Ruben Moreira, who was anonymous for most of his career, but a great artist. Dan Barry, Bob Lubbers, who was an assistant also to Al Capp on Little Abner. John Chilardo, Gil Kane, Mike Grell, Gray Morrow. Terracea magazine, Wally Wood published, called Wit's End.
I have heard of that. I think I've even seen some of this back in the day.
He produced some Burroughs Mars images, reproduced some Burroughs Mars images in Wit's End by Gray Morrow. And oh my gosh, full page, no context other than art. And it kind of helps to know the John Carter stories to appreciate the pieces, but it doesn't need context. The art is its own reward. And the artist who attunes himself to Burroughs can convey story without necessarily being surrounded by words. Of course, the words mean more when you've got a good illustration to go with them.
Absolutely. And you spoke of, you know, the masters of anatomy. What's amazing about most of the artists that I've seen in the history of Tarzan comics was not only were they master human anatomists, but myself being an armchair naturalist, which is not to be confused.
Gentleman naturalist, Cole. You're a gentleman naturalist.
That's right. But which is not to be confused with an armchair naturist, which is just somebody who sits around naked. But is that so many of these artists understand the dynamics of animals in motion. And that's a very difficult thing to, where it's not simply taking the, you know, Natural History Museum taxidermy mount and just sort of rearranging the component parts. It's the actual, you know, the sinews in motion that are just brilliantly portrayed. And I love when an artist draws an animal that looks like an animal in the wild.
That was probably what made Burroughs respond so well to Harold Foster, was that I've seen Foster work in films and in descriptions of his appearances at the Art Institute of Chicago, even when he was doing like a talk lecture in school, Foster would draw the skeleton before he put flesh on it.
Oh, wow.
And it's like, well, gosh, how did he ever meet a deadline? Well, he was pretty quick at it, too.
Muscle memory.
Oh, yeah. This is an amazing thing to consider. And
At least he didn't draw the entire circulatory system and, build his way out to the augmentary system.
Oh, yeah. That's an amazing fact. Of course, most of us don't do this. I certainly don't. Most of my colleagues kind of know what the skeleton's going to look like and go ahead and flesh it out first. And of course, that helps that you're working on a real deadline. And then there's some of us who just, you know, break all the rules. I've always wondered what a Tarzan strip drawn by Robert Crumb would look like.
Oh, geez.
Wow. I think Crumb would be better suited to John Carter, though, because there's much more current nudity. I just don't
imagine Crumb is
a Deja Thoris.
Crumb has his serious inclinations, yeah. And he has done some lovely depictions of Sheena, the female Tarzan.
Oh, yes. Now I'm going to have to
That brings me to an interesting question that I think interests me just as much as the history is. So you've got an established character in Tarzan. Did Tarzan – because what we start to see is we start to see Tarzan, but then we see Kazar. And then we then we see all these kind of the jungle pastiche start to roll out. How did Tarzan affect the industry? How did the idea of Tarzan start affecting the big houses and your industry? I've always been curious about that.
That was an inspiration to to many lesser talents. I used to have a classmate in high school whose kid brother was a big Tarzan fan, and this fellow would torment his brother by picking up one of the kid's comic books and misreading the title. He'd say, "Xantar of the Jungle." Nazrat of the Jungle, spoonerizing the name of the kids. Stop that. That's not funny. Well, actually, he wasn't far from the truth, because there were a whole bunch of Tarzan knockoffs.
I would see Robert Crumb doing Nazrat, though. I think that would be his title.
It's an amazing history, and one that I don't think it's going to be stopping anytime soon. Funny thing, I was just coincidentally taking a look at one of the Weissmuller pictures this afternoon, right about the time you sent the message. Tarzan New York Adventure.
Oh, we saw the trailer for that when we went to go see Legend of Tarzan at the Alamo.
Wow. Well, I was just idly wondering, how come nobody ever did a Weissmuller Tarzan comic book? Would have made a lot of sense.
Absolutely. Unless they were would be mired in further expense to have to get Burroughs and Weissmuller's okay. And yeah.
The licensing would have been a booger, but Johnny was a sweet guy. He probably would have given his blessing. I got to know him long after he had retired. He was a stockholder in Montgomery Ward, and the Wards used to put him on tour of their stores to promote his line of Johnny Weissmuller swimming pools, which you could hire Montgomery Ward to put in your backyard. And we got to spend a lot of time visiting, because I'd show up for the announced autograph session and I'd be the only one there. And it was kind of sad.
That's just terrible.
Then in the absence of any clamoring fans, I got to have a lot of visiting time one-on-one with Johnny Weissmuller. This was during the, junior high, early 60s. And he had already packed it in. He'd said goodbye to Tarzan after Tarzan and the Maids. He had picked up the threads of his career with Jungle Jim, which was like Father Knows Best in the Jungle.
Oh, wow.
And he handled that one pretty darn well, even though the pictures weren't a patch on what he had done as Tarzan.
That's I was not familiar with that aspect of his career.
Well, he had his heart broken, the death of a stunt double during the making of Tarzan and the Mermaids, about, 1948. High dive sequence turned bad. And he said, "That's it, no more Tarzan." And a very, very minor but prolific and lucrative producer named Sam Katzman approached him and says, "Hey, how about Jungle Jim?" Which, in a complete turnabout from Tarzan, Jungle Jim was based on a comic strip.
Oh. Interesting.
That had been drawn by Alex Raymond as a companion feature to Flash Gordon.
Wow. Wow, so it literally goes full circle then.
So Johnny Wyand Katzman was famous for doing the live-action Superman serials and a couple of Batman serials in the 40s, so Jungle Jim was the logical next step. And they never got any nearer to the jungle than the stock footage library.
It's in a back lot and a stock footage library.
Just lots of bamboo on the set. Now you're in the jungle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we need a jungle conflagration. Well, here's some footage from India. Okay, well, we need some crocodiles. Well, here's some footage of some alligators. And so they were notorious for mixing up the Americas with the
Florida. They're pretty much interchangeable.
And of course the kids seldom raised a fuss about the mismatching because, hey, it's Johnny Weissmore.
Yeah.
And it's Jungle Jim, and they had some lovely bursts of violence that reminded the kids of the Tarzan pictures.
You got the odd leaping lion, everybody's happy.
Oh yeah. So the relation, or the symbiotic relationship between the comics and the movies goes back a long way. Movies used to be a synonym for comics.
Interesting.
There were a number of comic strips that titled themselves with the word movies.
Oh, really? That is so true. I sort of half knew that.
See, kids, you aren't unique in this generation for this. This is
much like yes, exactly. Much like Popeye's origins coming from the comic strip Thimble Theater.
And Thimble Theater had originated before Popeye as a takeoff on another strip called Midget Movies.
That's amazing. I didn't know about that one either. And then there was at the Globe Theater, they had the Ye Old Thimble Theater, you know, a matinee for children that was, you know, Shakespeare didn't actually admit to having written any of those. Well, I thought it was interesting, Anna, you brought up Kazar, for example, as, you know, a blatant, you know, how do we have our own Marvel Tarzan?
Right.
We borrow again from Burroughs by having an internal Earth that is, I mean, essentially Burroughs' own center of the Earth, which I think everybody back then, something was going on in the middle of the world.
Yeah, had to be.
It's far more exciting than molten lava, harder to explain. But, you know.
We thought we had the ocean figured out.
Yeah.
We were wrong, but we thought we had the ocean figured out. So,
you know, essentially, they borrow Pellucidar from Burroughs. They call it the Savage Land. And Lord Kevin Plunder becomes Kazar of the Savage Land. And it's like, you have to be highborn white boy royalty to be a savage, apparently.
And in the meantime, you know, Black Panther's over here just shaking his head like, you bunch of idiots. Like, I'm going to stay over here, not raise a fuss, continue to mine this this vibranium, and you guys do your thing. We're good. We're good. You have your crazy white boys fighting saber-tooth tigers and swinging from trees. That's fine. I'm going to be over here. We're going to do this over here.
Everything fits. Everything ties together if you just stand back and watch.
That is amazing stuff. And of course, you know, after I discovered, after, you know, shunning John Carter initially in favor of Tarzan, because it was here were the two available right there on the bookshelves of these mall stores that are long gone. And, you know, Tarzan was the high profile, the well-known. And as I immersed myself, I'm like, whoa, wait a minute, this is not the Tarzan I have ever seen. And
right.
It was about that time that Filmation fielded their Tarzan cartoon.
Sure, and yeah.
What amazed me is that cartoon drew more from Burroughs than anything I had seen up to that point, once I knew, because it utilizes the ape language. Tarzan calls all of the animals by their ape names.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I noticed, especially in Marvel, for the longest, appears to have embraced that idea. You'll see covers where he's violently stabbing a spotted leopard while a black leopard is about to pounce on him. And it's like he wouldn't be so single-minded. he might sell a few scars on the back. But he is there just savagely stabbing away with presumably his father's knife and yelling, "Kriga, Tarzan kills." And Kriga was a warning that in the Mangani tribes, the tribes of the great apes, that was your last warning. You're about to get either kill or be killed. And so I love the fact
that. A lot of savagery there.
How did the savagery play? I'm curious, over time. So can we talk for a second about the evolution of the character from the early comic strip days to the way that he's portrayed now, not even so much in movies, but let's say in the comic book portrayals. Is it now closer to Burroughs' original work than it was in the strips, or is it vice versa? Because as, you know, because I understand the inherent violence of being, you know, the great king and liberator of the jungle. So you're going to have the fights, you're going to have the stabbings, you're going to have the punji pits and the alligator wrestling and the, you know, all of that. But I imagine that when the strips first came out, you weren't going to really portray it at the level of violence that it was on the written page, because you can get away with a lot more.
Well, the syndicates, the newspaper syndicates had certain guidelines against violence. They had a
right.
terrific bias against serpents, for example.
Huh.
Really? Yeah.
So Hista the Serpent was right out.
People reading the pulps sought out violence. Your typical newspaper reader, your average newspaper reader, probably had more delicate sensibilities, but still loved adventure.
So yeah, it does seem in looking at some of the newspaper strips that Tarzan will, grapple with an ape and then just kind of let it go rather than break its neck.
It's a gentleman's game. It's a game of honor and
diplomacy.
That's right.
Like, oh, I have bested you, sir. Good day to Tarzan. I will
exactly.
not turn to root for grubs.
Rules of engagement. But Ed Burroughs was for all the necessary violence in the stories, Burroughs was nonetheless a very tasteful writer.
And so
you weren't, it wasn't what Clive Barker, as Clive Barker puts it, it wasn't a story that means to do you harm. But it was a story that was going to raise some of the fine hairs on the back of your neck.
Now, he was a gentleman savage.
Yeah, well, yeah, definitely by birthright.
That's right. Once he embraced his history, he was. But he could still be. If you crossed him, he to quote Buckaroo Banzai, he would just soon shoot, kill you as go fishing.
That's right.
But and above all, Burroughs was an instinctive storyteller. He was one of those guys who really didn't just sit down and draw a blueprint for a story. He'd just start writing.
You feel that organic nature having read all of the 24 Tarzan stories that were published as full-length novels and all but the final collection of John Carter stories. You do get that organic feel. It's like once the first couple of paragraphs are written, the story just sort of you can get that feel. It just takes on a life of its own.
And that's a great line of instinctive heritage there. Burroughs, O. Henry, Mark Twain, the kind of artists who last are the ones who just let it happen.
And what's also fascinating, and it'd be interesting to see if anyone caught on to this in the comics, because it would be almost impossible to do without confusing the narrative in a visual form. One of the things that fascinated me early on in reading Burroughs, and I have gone on record saying I can't recommend enough that people discover his work, is that sometimes you would read like three chapters and you would get to the next chapter and suddenly realize mid-chapter, this is taking place at exactly the moment three chapters ago start.
Mm-hmm.
Something would happen, like someone would crash a plane, and then you would get deeper into the story, and the other characters who were separated would be doing something, and all of a sudden that same plane is flying overhead, and they watch it crash. And you're like, wait, that was the plane that he was in, the guy before, and Tarzan came. And, and it was a wonderful sense of just, well, you know, while that was going on, without telling you while that was going on.
Right.
Right.
It's a structural... It's a structural conceit that a lot of modern-day artists, mid-century to the present day, have picked up in film. Quentin Tarantino uses that to good effect.
Absolutely. It sort of presupposes the intelligence of your audience, which is another way I think Burroughs rises above pulp.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, pulp is its own worst enemy. A lot of pulp, a good many pulp stories, are over obvious and condescending. Of course, a lot of highfalutin literature is over obvious and condescending. So that may be a constant among a majority of writers who don't trust their reader to get it.
Exactly.
Burroughs not only said it's okay not to get it, but I'm going to assume that you can. And if the writer assumes intelligence on the part of the reader, then the reader rises to the occasion.
I had never thought of it that way, but I think that's exactly what we're lacking all too often today, is allowing an audience, be it a reader, or in visual media, someone watching or observing or following something, to, like you say, rise to the occasion, to be the very person the author is writing to, even if you didn't realize you were.
And if you compliment your reader by assuming intelligence, the reader will respond favorably and might even look for your next book.
Excellent. Well, now I have to touch on something that is unique to Tarzan in comics. Because there was an event that occurred out of a conversation, I believe at San Diego Comic-Con, if I remember the story, it might have been New York, among a group of Dark Horse creators over at Dark Horse Comics. Mm-hmm. And someone just said, out of the blue, Aliens versus Predator. And that got a ball rolling that became a franchise in its own right, both for the comic company and for the studio. Mm-hmm. But it also launched, it became like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles launched the, what did we call it, prepubescent radioactive animal species or something
like
that. Yeah. When I was working for Eclipse in the 80s, they had I had nothing to do with it. I was doing the Prowler with an air boy with Tim Truman. But there was an Eclipse series called Adolescent Radioactive Black Belt Hamsters.
Oh, yes, indeed.
we spoke to that. Absolutely, yeah.
And a nice piece of work it was, too. I mean, sometimes a pastiche can meet or exceed its model.
Because that was actually one of the few that took a very clever approach to jumping on the bandwagon, as it was, where most were just sort of, hey, let's get in on this while it's hot. And what the Aliens versus Predator, which the original Dark Horse was a very well, it was, I thought that should have been the movie. Because it was written like a movie. But what it did was launch, it was like the starting gun for blank versus blank.
Yeah.
And, or any number of, even if they weren't necessarily versing one another, as it were, it brought together a whole slew of combining popular characters. And I think the greatest testament to the staying power of Tarzan as a part of the modern condition is the fact that Tarzan teamed up with Batman, Superman. He fought Predator at the Earth's core. He even joined up with his brother Burroughs' creation, John Carter, in Warlords of Mars, published by Dark Horse. And we couldn't talk about Tarzan in comics without addressing the fact that it is such a well-known and timeless character that it can be comfortably inserted into any universe. And everybody's like, well, it's Tarzan. Of course he would, Tarzan versus aliens. You would probably find some way to make that make sense.
Makes perfect sense to me. Of course, the Monster Mash. The Monster Mash formula is pretty well tenured thanks to Universal Pictures.
Oh, that's so true. I never really made the connection that that would was literally kind of the perhaps the underlying, if not conscious, inspiration for Aliens versus Predator. Because
Dracula and Frankenstein. It is a most interesting, background story about Universal's very lucrative monster franchises. You've seen the film from 1945 called House of Frankenstein.
Yes.
Yes.
That originally was to be a meetup with the Frankenstein monster, Dracula, the Wolfman, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Probably might have thrown the mummy in there one time. But the original motivating conceit of House of Frankenstein was that it was also going to be a Sherlock Holmes adventure.
Whoa.
I've got some correspondence, not a trade announcement, but just some internal memos talking about a film called The Devil's Brood, in which Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce, as Holmes and Watson, would have a standoff with the classic Universal monsters.
Oh.
Might have been fun.
Would have been real fun.
That is fascinating.
And of course, there's your genesis of Van Helsing 10 or 12 years ago. Certainly Freddy versus Jason. Certainly many. And then, of course, the Alien Predator matchups. And too bad it never happened, but then probably just as well it doesn't.
It could have been very, very bad. As wonderful as it could have been dreadful.
It's more interesting to imagine sometimes than to witness.
Exactly.
And there you have it.
As we come up against the hour mark, I did want to mention my Bader Meinhof moment that we have almost every time we do any research for a show. I was just on Reddit looking around my normal stuff, of course, Tarzan in my mind because we were going to speak to Tarzan, and a trademark notification popped up. Like I saw the link for it, and I clicked it, and it was the voice mark. Trademark for Tarzan's signature yell. There's a voice mark trademarked. This is 2.5 to 3 full paragraphs describing the yell down to the notes used, the length of the notes used, in order to trademark it so that no one else could use it for toy action figures is the statement. But yeah, everything from a semi-long sound in the chest register to number two is a short sound up an interval in one octave, then a short sound down a major third from the
I'm taking notes here because I don't want to accidentally copy right here.
Literally, and if you read it and you imagine it, it is the Tarzan yell. So how does that the Tarzan yell, how did that come into being and how did that translate into comics?
Plus you didn't want to have Slim Whitman stealing that.
Right.
As another yodeler.
Steve Martin comes along. You could technically call it a yodel. But I honestly do not know. I'm sure one could look it up. I do not know how that combination of notes and timbre came into being, but it certainly makes sense.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, it did come out of, I think, a necessity to find some way to make an approachable replacement for Burroughs in the novels, in the books. Burroughs, the big loud utterance that rings through the African jungle or the midst of some lost world somewhere, because back then you could get enough of Africa was unexplored. You could say, we can't get there. There must be like Roman legions still living there. They may not, but who knows? It's possible. But it was the victory cry of the bull ape.
There you go.
Anything you can imagine, if you're thinking of what a bull ape might sound like, is not exactly conducive to good cinema, especially in that day.
Oh, no. Grunts and groans are never that recognizable. And if you codify it to a melodic sound that is still pretty ferocious.
Yes.
Then you're going to come up with a trademark. When Jimmy Drake, a recording artist of the 1950s, had a string of novelty hit records. You still hear him from time to time on the Dr. Demento show. He did a had a hit record in 1957, I believe it was, called Ape Call.
Amazing.
And he hired a disc jockey friend who could do not a note perfect Tarzan yell, but a very simplified Tarzan yell that would fit the rhythm of the song. And, well, about that time, of course, Tarzan was getting to be all over the local TV late shows. This record called Ape Call came out. And I'm sure there must have been many school teachers driven to drink by third graders on the playground going around doing the Tarzan yodel.
Well, you know, suddenly everyone showing up to school in coonskin caps seemed like an okay thing.
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, of course, kids are very susceptible.
Like David Crockett.
Well, I think kids, we all know what, we're gonna do, what I'm going to do with Ape Call.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you can look the record up. It's probably on YouTube by now.
Oh, it is. But, and I already have found it. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, exactly. Done and done, sir. Done and done.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Jimmy Drake had a pseudonym. He called himself Nervous Norbus. And he had a pretty good string of hit records, which were basically a one-man band thing. I mean, it wasn't really rock and roll. He would sing and accompany himself on a ukulele and a bass drum, stomping it.
That is...
And he made the top 40 more times than you'd expect.
It's almost like the Weird Al of his day. You know, he started out with an accordion and a friend with drumsticks on the accordion case.
Right.
That's all you need.
There are always... Everything has a precedent, no matter how esoteric or seemingly innovative.
Much like, William Shakespeare's Thimble Theater was in its day.
Right, exactly. History breeds and seeds in strange ways and places, as a wise colleague of mine once observed. And she was right. I mean, it still does.
Well, so that's what? Oh, go ahead, because I could talk Tarzan all day long.
So we've talked about the precedent of Tarzan. You know, Tarzan through time. Tarzan is not going to go anywhere. Tarzan is still, to this day, we just had a movie release. Tarzan is still a household name. If you do the Tarzan call, people know the Tarzan call. Kids are born with the inherent knowledge of Tarzan, iPads and Tarzan. They just, when you're born, you know how to use those two things. You know what they are. What's next for Tarzan? Let's try to be prescient on the Tarzan tip. What's next for Tarzan now? We've seen the new movie. Are we talking a franchise now? Do you think it'll do well enough?
It's getting mixed reviews, but very favorable responses from people who know Tarzan.
Okay.
It is
A lot of my working artist friends have been raving about it. I haven't seen the new picture yet, but I will. And I really don't need recommendations to know that I do want to see it, but I've heard some very kind words about it from some working cartoonists and artists whom I admire.
And I can say, as someone who knows the flavor of the character, knows the Burroughs Tarzan, there is so much that is very reminiscent of Burroughs' work while still maintaining originality and not just simply adapting a single work.
Well, I mean, otherwise, why adapt?
So true.
If you're just going to pay blind homage to the original creation, you might as well just put a new edition of the first book out. Taj Mahal, the great blues singer, once said that indigenous music would never survive if it were performed with arthritic reverence. Well, he was right. Yeah, I mean, he was right, and then some, and that applies to anything that you want to see preserved. I think the future of Tarzan is more back to basics with meaningful embellishments. I don't think we need a bionic Tarzan. I don't think we need a time-traveling Tarzan. I think we just need a good old robust jungle man who is classy but not too classy, who knows enough of his origins that he really wants to turn his back on him rather than accept administration of the Greystoke estate. You know, like, let me out of here. I'm going back to the jungle. this is the sort of thing that I think will define the future of Tarzan, which is really pretty straightforward. The new film seems to honor that imperative very well. And if the promising returns on opening are consistent, there could be an entirely new series.
I would like this to last long enough to where they feel confident that the audience will accept Pellucidar, because I would personally love to see Tarzan at the Earth's core.
Oh, I love that, yes. And that would not be any violation of anything. That would make perfect sense. Burr's imagination is too big to be contained by one narrow view.
Absolutely. And it's nice to see so much homage paid to Burroughs' vision while also allowing for a kind of cultural consistency. There's enough in there that it makes it approachable no matter where you've encountered Tarzan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the comics did that very well, too, from what I've seen personally and from what I've just in researching this, just amazing. The main imperative always seems to be, if you judge a book by its cover, Tarzan is in perpetual peril, out of which he will almost certainly rise triumphant, but it's just one damn thing after another. Look at the history.
Well, you gotta have that. I don't need to see Tarzan lounging in a hammock unless he's about to get knocked out of it by a gorilla. That's the same thing with war movies. I mean, you put a platoon or a Sands of Iwo Jima or any of the acknowledged great movies about war out in front of an audience of combat veterans and say, oh, no, it wasn't like that at all. We were mostly bored.
Yeah.
And of course, then you realize it's not the imperative of the adventure film to show lulls between the action. The lull serves to set the audience up for a new outburst of action.
Well, it would be like NYPD Blue if half the episode was just everybody doing their paperwork.
Right.
Well, I like to think of it as the 364 days that Jack Bauer has the good days in 24. Those are Tarzan's bad days, and Tarzan's one good day is Jack Bauer's bad day. His 24 hours that he has to spend.
The one day he gets to like go to the House of Lords and speak on some issue of the day. And before we close, I have to point out there were a couple of Tarzan covers I remember distinctly seeing as a kid. I didn't actually own these comics myself, but I believe this was probably Joe Kubert art. But there's one where he's being attacked by a great ape, a Mgani, or perhaps a gorilla, a Bolgani, for those of you familiar with Tarzan. And he's sort of got this unusual approach to kind of trying to choke him out from the front, where he's got his arm outstretched.
Doesn't work very well.
It's like just underneath the jaw. And then the one that really bothered me as a kid, because I didn't get a good enough look at it to work out the perspective, where he's on the back of a lion prepared to just drive his knife home into the savage heart, and his right arm appears to be just missing at about the joint, at the other joint. And because of the shadow play there, it's obvious looking at it as an adult, this is meant to be, his arm is lost in the shadow underneath this animal's jaw. But it looked like, what happens? The lion ate his arm? Tarzan's arm. It doesn't happen.
just Tarzan doesn't have a Lazarus pit, does he? Yeah, just laying around that you can...
That's good observational note.
I could not let an episode on Tarzan go without having some catharsis from my childhood there. So.
Yeah, but at least those things were exciting. A lot of the Del Tarzan covers were just like snapshots from Tarzan's family album.
That is well put, because I looked at a lot of Del covers, and it's mostly him just like smiling, and there's a rhino.
Right.
Yeah, they.
There's Boondock Rhinoceros. Hi.
Del was so terrified of the comic book censors, even though they had refused to join the Comics Code Authority, that they kept things pretty bland.
Well,
didn't publish some great work.
I'll have to use this cover that I discovered earlier, and when you said that, I had to go back to it. It is Tarzan very leisurely, very placidly scooping his little fish trap out of a river that he's in to about hip deep.
Mm.
And it's just sort of pulling it gently out of the water, full of delicious African fishes, and some parrots flutter by in the background. And thus is South Africa sublimed to.
My favorites are probably the Hogarth newspaper strip, which has that combination of high adventure and dignity about it, illustrative dignity. Pretty much a novelistic approach in the comics, just like Burroughs. Of course, novelistic treatment is not unusual in a novel, but novelistic treatment is unusual in a comic strip. So you find that in a newspaper strip and hang on to it. You've got something there. I stuck with the movies even after Weissmuller, and sometimes I was pleased and sometimes I was disappointed. I thought Lex Barker made a pretty good Tarzan. He would be the one whose face appears on a lot of the Del comics because of the period coinciding. But my uncle made a career running movie theaters, and he always loved to play on words. And one day in 1958, he shows up at the house and says, "Come on, I'm going to take you down to the theater. We're going to preview the latest Tarzan movie." I says, "Oh, boy, what's the name of it?" He says, "It's called Tarzan Fights His Wife." Say, what? Well, of course, it was called Tarzan Fight for Life. But my uncle couldn't resist. But he didn't tell me that until we were in the theater. He said, "Oh boy, he's gonna get a frying pan thrown at him."
That's the Harold Pinter play version, right? Where it's just like one scene, one shot play of a kitchen and Tarzan and his wife arguing over finances.
Yeah.
That's the Jigs and Maggie version.
That's right.
Wow. Amazing stuff.
Brilliant.
Oh, man. Well, Cole, why don't you...
a better place to end than Tarzan Fights His Wife.
Michael, thank you again. You are amazing. You are always... It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
I wish we could just
have you on all the time, but I know that you're a busy man doing a lot of good work. Is there anything that you want to plug for our listening audience right now, the things that where they can find you or things you've got upcoming, anywhere that they can get a hold of you?
Well, the new 10th volume of the Forgotten Horrors movie books is just published at Amazon.com.
Nice.
And I just last week put the finishing touches on a new book for IDW called A Voodoo Volume 2, which reprints the great pre-censorship horror comic Voodoo in its entirety.
That's fantastic.
Wow. That's neat.
A lot of things happening. The big project right now, speaking of Tarzan's New York adventure, is the new edition of my biography of Mantan Moreland, the great comedian appears in Tarzan's New York adventure.
Wonderful.
So it all ties together.
Yeah, all things come full circle.
Yes.
And it's amazing that the Tarzan Fights His Wife joke didn't come up in that movie.
Right.
With such a wit of his day there.
Crazy business. Nice work if you can get away with it.
Absolutely. That's wonderful.
Right.
Where can, I guess, obviously we can, people can look up your body of work on Amazon.
Yeah, there's a pretty good representative page there at Amazon, and stuff keeps happening, and more to the better. I'm uncertain of what the next big project's going to be, but I think it's probably going to be split between a new volume of Forgotten Horrors and a new survey that John Woolley and I are putting together of the Beach Party films.
What? Oh, that's wow. Awesome.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh,
that's a piece and, of Americana right there.
That's Americana. We were going to do a chapter on Beach Party and its sequels in the 9th volume of Forgotten Horrors, because they do have some spooky business show up from time to time. And the more we dug into the research, it's like, gosh, there's a book in here.
Yes.
And probably one covering ground that never has been covered before, despite a number of serious scholarly studies of the Beach Party phenomenon. And plus I've got about 5 interviews with Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello that never have been published in their entirety. So here you go.
That is amazing stuff.
Do you ever stop? Are you consistently kinetic? Do you never look back?
Never look back. Something might be gaining on you.
Well done.
Good advice for Tarzan and for
that's
for
so
you,
true, because you never know what's coming up on you in the cover of a Tarzan comic.
Speaking of what's coming up, coming up for us?
Well, as you're listening to this, if you're catching it on Friday, tomorrow I will be wandering around at the North Texas Comic Book Show, where you can see my co-host from the Rancor Pit, Eddie Medina, out there selling his wares and his wonderful artwork. And we have, we're going to be launching in July Hey Kids Comics Quarterly, #1, the best comic I ever read. And it's going to be chock full of interviews that we've been meaning to do for 3 years now.
Yes, we have.
And you'll get to hear some more great stories about, what individuals that we've talked to consider the single best comic that just stuck with them. And we have, I'm veg. I have so much going on at the Jedi Cole Universe at JediCole.com, where you can find this and all kinds of other goodies. And we are going to be launching very soon a brand new look for the site. So
we are on the precipice.
Yeah.
We are on the very razor's edge, the event horizon of launching a new site.
We've just sort of been teetering there, and we're about to jump into that. So look for that. It'll be a new, improved version. It'll be a lot easier to find things. It'll look really cool. And Andrew's done amazing work to make that happen, because, as you know, I am the unfrozen caveman of technology. And you can write to us. Please write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com. And let us know if you have a best comic you ever read you'd like to talk about. We occasionally tweet when I manage to get my knuckles off the ground and do that, at the Jedi Cole U on Twitter. And if you get a chance, check out the Rancor Pit YouTube page, where you can catch all of the live Rancor Pit shows, past and present, and also the Rancor bits that Eddie's been putting together for us over there.
Very nice. And thank you again to Michael. Thank you, Cole.
Lovely. So
good. Once again, you can join us next week for more high adventure and ribaldry right here at Hey Kids Comics. Next week, what do we got coming up, Cole?
I believe next week is the Salon des Refusés.
I'm very excited for that
show. We are going to talk about the comic books nobody gave too much of a damn about that they really want to.
Thank you, guys. Join us next week for more Hey Kids Comics.
Good night. Good night.
Ape call, doodly-abba, ape call, doodly-abba, ape call, doodly-abba. Don't be a square, Joe, go ape. Now old Papa Tiger was the boss of the Nile, just a sport model cat with a solid style. He was old King Cool till the girl tiger smiled. Ape call, doodly-abba, ape call, doodly-abba, ape call, doodly-abba. Bezorch daddy-o, go ape. Adam was the first boy in the land, the big Mallaroonie daddy with an iron hand. But when little Eva said, hi, man. Ape call, doodly-abba, ape call, doodly-abba, ape call, doodly-abba. Don't be a cube rube, go ape. So remember to ape call today.